The following Aloud podcast was recorded live in 2008 at the historic Central Library in the heart of downtown LA as part of the award-winning Aloud series presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Aloud podcasts are made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arent Fox and by individual contributions from listeners like you. For more information on Aloud, or to find out how you, too, can support the Los Angeles Public Library, please visit our website, www.aloudla.org. Honor Moore is the author of three collections of poems, Red Shoes, Darling, and Memoir. Her biography, The White Blackbird, A Life of the Painter Margaret Sargent by her granddaughter, was a New York Times notable book in 1996. Her play, Morning Pictures, was produced on Broadway and published in the New Women's Theater, 10 plays by contemporary American women, which she edited. She currently teaches in the graduate writing program at the New School in Columbia. Moore's recent book, The Bishop's Daughter, chronicles her relationship with her famous father, Paul Moore, who was the Episcopal Bishop of New York from 1972 to 1989. Born to privilege, Paul Moore embraced a radical form of Christianity that focused on social justice. He marched with Martin Luther King Jr. and Dorothy Day. Honor Moore's memoir was instigated by the revelation of her father's bisexuality. This past March, as some of you probably know, The New Yorker published an excerpt of Moore's book, and it provoked what Newsweek called a minor scandal. Two of her siblings wrote letters disavowing the memoir, yet others, including those within her family and the Episcopal Church, applauded her candid portrayal of her father. Having written my own memoir about my father, I was eager to read Moore's book. I found it moving, brave, psychologically incisive. As she explores how her father's secrets impacted her own sexuality, she subjects her own memories to rigorous scrutiny. Ultimately, I found she is deeply compassionate of her father's life and, in the context of the time in which he lived, the choices he felt he had to make. In conversation with Honor Moore tonight, I'm thrilled to welcome Dr. George Regas, the celebrated former rector of All Saints Church in Pasadena, California. I'm sure many of you know George. Dr. Regas retired from All Saints in May of 1995 after 28 years in the job. He's now executive director of the Regas Institute, which was established in 1998, which is dedicated to the study and examination of progressive religion. And I believe we have several of the Institute's board members here tonight, and I especially welcome you here. The predominant focus of Dr. Regas's 28 years at All Saints Church in Pasadena was in the arena of peace and justice. He led the congregation to oppose the Vietnam War, the escalating nuclear arms race, and the Gulf War. He established many programs of responding to human needs, an AIDS service center, a medical program for uninsured children, a shelter for the homeless, and the Coalition for a Nonviolent City. He knew Paul Moore personally, and he is also someone who cares deeply about the direction and the future of the Episcopal Church, and indeed someone who cares deeply about all humanity. I'm very honored to present to you both Honor Moore and Dr. George Regas. Thank you.
It's wonderful to be here tonight with all of you and to share with Honor Moore. I did know Bishop Paul Moore. I knew him for decades and had a great affection for him. He was a great bishop. He had a passion for social justice and a deep commitment to peace. When Louise asked me 6 months ago if I would be in conversation with Honor Moore about her book, A Bishop's Daughter. Since I knew Bishop Moore, I happily said that I would. I did not know anything about the content of the book. And so, what a surprise. But a happy surprise to read Honor's thrilling, honest, life-transforming story. Anna takes us through so many different emotional places with her father. Enchantment, confusion, failure, shocking disclosure, anger, disdain, being turned on sexually by her father, refusal to forgive, real forgiveness, distance, closeness, love, reconciliation. It's a beautiful and challenging read. Now, why did you write that book?
You Episcopal priests always ask such hard questions.
I was trained.
I'm a poet, and I have a habit of writing what comes into me. And this book fought me for many years, even before my father died. I had chunks of things that I would write, and then I would put them in a folder. A couple of times I tried to start a book, got sort of 60 pages in, and I was just too angry. And finally, really very close to my father's death, that anger lifted, and then I knew I had a story, and I felt that, and I knew I had to tell it because it was all right there in front of me, and I wouldn't be able to go forward without going through it. I knew I had a story. I didn't know exactly what the story was, but I knew I had a story.
You worked on it how long?
In some ways all my life, but about 3.5 years, from contract to publication.
Why don't you read the prologue?
Okay.
I really think that's beautiful.
I'm just going to read the first page. It is Easter, and in the darkness of the Cathedral of St. John the Divine, the singing soars in descant, the Gothic ceiling multiplying the clamor. And now, as if a great storm has ceased, there is no music, and in the silence held by 3,000 worshippers, there come 3 resounding knocks. And as we wait, the massive doors swing open. An ethereal shaft of sunlight floods the dark. The roar of the city breaks the gigantic quiet. And there, at the far end of the aisle, in a blaze of morning light, stands the tall figure of a man, my flesh and blood father, the bishop. When I was a child, I accepted my father as a force of imagination that flared and burst and coruscated, an instrument of transformation. During World War II, he had survived a Japanese bullet and had a scar to prove it. If my heart had been going this way instead of that, he announced once, rowing me across the lake in the Adirondacks, you would never have existed. Remembering his saying that now, I am startled. It was a joke, of course, but it was also the text of a lesson that endured throughout our life together. My father had supernatural powers. His fate had determined my existence. I was something he had made and would continue to make. Physical independence from my physical parents was one thing. I got too big to hold my mother's hand, too big to ride my father's shoulders. But it took me decades to escape the enchantment of my father's priesthood.
And the book is the story of escaping that enchantment. Oh. Well, I read just recently the Los Angeles Times review. It was really very beautiful, very perceptive. Mm. And the reviews that I've read have really been terrific. But I'm sure you've had some challenging responses to that book. How would you describe how people have responded to that very provocative book?
Well, interestingly, I think some people have responded with fear. A priest who I think he wouldn't mind if I said, Ledley Lachlan, who was with my father in Jersey City, read the manuscript, and he said, it's a great manuscript. And then when he had a real book in his hands, he said, I'm dismayed that you let all this out. And then later he said, I really should, oh, he wrote me that in a note. And later he said, I really should write you another note, because now I feel that, he said two things. One was, I think the Holy Spirit is moving. And the other, he said, well, I think your father is smiling in heaven. It's a very sweet thing. But so I think people have a kind of initial shock and fear. And then many people have sort of allowed themselves to surrender to the book. And then I've been surprised by people's sort of positive responses and curiosity. And relief, I think, relief to be able to talk about these issues, and also fascination that this man whom they admired, the mystery was, why did he do all that stuff? And somehow this story helps to answer that question for some people, that they understand that he had some suffering of his own, which made him feel an outsider, and that perhaps gave him a kind of living compassion for others.
There's a line in the book that captivated my mind, and I've held it close to me. What goes unresolved never loses its power. Share with me how you wove that poignant line into your father's story.
Well, I don't remember exactly where that is, but
page 66.
Page 6. Oh. I do remember really page 66. Anyway, doesn't matter. But I know that that's what I felt about my life with my father. I felt if I couldn't resolve this, if I couldn't find my way to him, I would be in the grip of a kind of painful hatred and anger for the rest of my life. And I really, I think love is one of the great gifts that we human beings have to get to. And I would much rather be in loving with someone than in separation and anger.
I would like to go now to March 1989. Mm-hmm. When you get a desperate call from your father that he wants to talk to you, and that phone call changed everything. And so I would like for you to take us into that revelation.
Well, I think it was in August of 1990, actually. I think you're thinking about, there was a kind of conversation I had with a friend of my mother's in which she told me that that my mother had suspected that my father was homosexual. But the summer that Iraq invaded Kuwait, I was in Europe. I came home. There were family phone messages, and I said, "Oh, I'll do it tomorrow when I don't have jet lag." And in the morning, I was sitting in my house in Connecticut, and the phone rang, and my father said, "Are you by yourself?" It was a very strange question. I said, "Yes, here." And he said a very peculiar sentence. He said, "It's come out that I've had gay affairs." And by the end of the conversation, he said, "I'd like to come and talk to you about it." And I said, "Oh, how wonderful." And at the time, I had 15 years of my life I was with women. And I was, that was still where I was. And I thought, well, finally I kind of selfishly thought, this is a way I can get back connected to my father. Then I thought, how painful. I had no idea he had had that kind of pain that it would take to live that kind of double life. So I thought we could talk about these things because we actually, when I was younger, had talked about such things. But do you want me to read this?
Read about that for us.
I will read about that. He came to visit on a quintessentially beautiful September day. The day was sky was saturated blue, the green beginning to turn gold. We drove the familiar roads past Kent School and up Skiff Mountain. We parked the car and began to walk. The khaki trousers, the frayed Shetland sweater, he seemed nervous. After some conversation about how difficult it had been for him in the Adirondacks, answering questions from the family about a life he had never wanted to reveal, we began to talk. And after a while, I asked the only question that concerned me. Did you love any of them? They were all nice people, he said. Did he mean he hadn't loved them, or was he just dodging the question? I didn't want to believe he hadn't loved them. If, as he taught, one's existence was inextricably bound up with the liturgy, and if he had lived his life with the attention to the life of Christ that his preaching always evidenced, how could he now deny those he had sexually loved? St. Peter and the others in Gethsemane, art not thou also one of this man's disciples? He saith, I am not. Did not I see thee in the garden with him? Peter then denied again. I wanted to know that my father had experienced passion, that he had known love. The life my father had lived had brought suffering to my mother and to my stepmother, but I had no judgment of his infidelity to his wives. I understood desire. But if my father had sacrificed the happiness of the two women whom he had married and now his children's trust, I wanted to believe that he had loved these unidentified men. Did you love any of them? I don't want to talk any further about it. I would never have chosen to have this thing come out. Silence. I have some trouble with it, Pop, I said. Not with what you did, but with the deception. It will take some time to, I was going to say, adjust to this new reality, but suddenly my father was shouting, well, he was furious. You haven't had a perfect life. You had affairs with women when you lived with Venable, man I had lived with. What I wanted him to say was something tender. I wanted him to say, I am very sorry. The lie has hurt you. I did the best I could. I tried to keep it a secret so your mother and Brenda wouldn't suffer. I tried to change, but I could not because I love men. Instead, he was accusing me of deception in order to justify his own. No, I did not have affairs with women while I lived with Venable. I said, I told Venable 2 weeks after I fell in love with Victoria and then I left him. There is nothing in my life that compares to what you've done. Nothing at all. If he would only tell me something really true, something that would allow me to know this part of him, I could forgive him. I was so disappointed looking at him, cowering there in the darkness of the kitchen, and so sad. He wanted forgiveness, but offering forgiveness would be something for nothing, and I didn't have anything to give him.
Did he love any of those men?
Well, I believe he did. I believe he did. What he said was, I never have fallen in love. He said to others, I've never fallen in love with a man. But what I think is that, what I know from my own life is that for me, falling in love with a woman and falling in love with a man are two different things. And that I could call one falling in love and another something else. That's what I imagine my father did. I had an experience. Just after I started the book, I went to London to cover the primates' special meeting about the consecration of Gene Robinson. And before I went to St. John the Divine to get some you know, help. And I was given a letter written by a man who said he'd been a friend of my father's for 30 years, and he wanted to have some of the videotapes that had been played after my father's funeral, and he wanted to visit his grave. And so I wrote him back, and I said, and I want to hear about Patmos, because this man had gone to Patmos in Greece with my father the last summer of his life. And I got back from London, and I didn't hear from him. And then one day in mid-November of 2003, I was unpacking things actually my father had left me, and I had a terrific headache, and I thought, well, I'll just start to read this little part. As it happened, it was my father's birthday, and my father's absence still sailed through me like a dark ship, alternating with images of his dying, the visceral sense of his love that afternoon in his sunny bedroom days before he died, when I sat watching him, along with some of my sisters, all of us imagining what our family might have been had we always had the love from him we felt that day. Then the telephone rang. This is Andrew Verver. He had a confident voice. Andrew Verver was the only name in my father's will that was unfamiliar when we sat in the lawyer's office the day before the funeral. The moment had passed without comment, but later Rosie, my sister, identified Andrew as the man who had gone with my father to Patmos the summer before. "I need someone to look after the tickets, you know," my father had said at the time. "This is Andrew Verver," said the voice on the telephone. His voice was soft in texture. The beginning of the conversation was formal. "Your father was a close friend of mine, yes, for almost 30 years, yes. You said so in your letter. I'm sorry I didn't call sooner. I was about to. I had feelings. Today is his birthday." "Oh, yes. Oh, I didn't know that. Right, his birthday." Andrew had been a student at Columbia, a Roman Catholic. "I was considering being received into the Episcopal Church," he said. "I went to your father for advice. He was very helpful. And after a while, we became friends. He had an accent I couldn't place. Boston? Near Boston, it turned out. We were very close friends." "Should I write this down?" I reached for a notebook and a pen. Andrew was silent, but I could hear him there. I couldn't get over his humility, the calm in his voice, how he could wait through a silence. "Your father was a good friend to me," he said. "I'm so glad," I repeated. "Good friend," I wrote. We had been talking for about 20 minutes. I kept being afraid he would hang up, that he would stop talking about my father, telling me these things. "Oh, please don't hang up." "Your father told me a great deal," Andrew said. "Yes," I said. And then suddenly I realized I should take advantage of talking to this man who was so close to my father. "Did he tell you about us, about me? You had some problems with each other." "Yes," I said. "We did." "Did he talk to you about his sexual life? Two men in Greece in the bright evening sun?" "I was his sexual life," Andrew said. I've cut. That was the short
part. How long were they friends, lovers?
30 years. You know, I presume off and on. But almost 30 years, yeah.
And at one point, your father, when his second wife, Brenda, had died, he was no longer the Bishop of New York, and he and Andrew had gone to Patmos.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, "I'm free now, why don't we just get together and make a life together. We have been friends and we've created something beautiful over these 30 years. Let's be together." And what happened with that?
Well, what really happened. But I like your version. What really happened was that my father was free. He was, as Andrew said to me, he was getting more gay. Your father was getting more gay. But what was happening to Andrew was that he was getting less gay. And he had actually met a woman and was planning, they were planning to marry. And he had just met her when they went to Patmos. And when my father came home, one of my sisters said to him, "So how was Andrew?" And he said, "Oh, he talked about his girlfriend the whole time." And we thought, "Yeah, right." You know, but it turned out to be the it turned out to be the case. So it's just an evidence of the kind of, I mean, Jack Miles calls it the in the blurb on the, this is just a galley, there's no paperback yet. He calls it sort of, the book has to do with the malleability of sexuality, but it's also the mysteries of sexual love, the mysteries of physical love. You know, who knows where life leads us if we're open to
it. And did Andrew get married?
Andrew got married. He's now been married for about 5 years.
I want to...
He introduced his fiancée to my father.
What did Paul say?
"You look very good together."
You are one of 9 children.
Yeah.
I mean, that in itself is a book. Right? I mean...
It's not one I'll write.
But it saddened me all the way through the book how you made it clear that you had not gotten the care that you needed and you wanted. And there was no one there. And I can remember in the book you said, over all those years, none of the parents ever said, "You are a beautiful person." And every time a new child came, instead of rejoicing, well, you did rejoice, but you knew that that meant less love and care for you.
I didn't consciously know that, but I knew that. And I had a kind of revelation. I was in our family place in the Adirondacks with several of my siblings and their children and having a beautiful time with them. And I was in my room going through scrapbooks. And, you know, there would be pages about Jersey City and social activism. And then there would be a page that was a sheaf of telegrams. And they would say, "Oh, we're so congratulations on the birth of so-and-so." So this happened, you know, it got to be a kind of pattern in my reading of the scrapbooks. And all I can tell you, I didn't really plan to... I mean, this wasn't conscious, but I just suddenly, fell into a deep sleep, is all I can say. And as I was passing out from this re-experiencing, I heard the footsteps of my little nieces and nephews on the boardwalk outside, and my beloved sisters and brothers shouting at their children, and it was double, you know. It was, I love these people, and yet. My mother wanted a baseball team.
One of the sad moments in the book to me was, I can't remember the setting, but there was this woman who had just beautiful legs. Just beautiful legs. And you go home and ask your father, "What do you think of my legs?" And he said, "They are a little thick."
He said that.
He said that.
Yeah.
Huh. You should have thought.
Not his greatest moment. I should have what?
Your mother's Brahmin genealogy and your father's enormous wealth, they had to have shaped your life substantially. How do you see that?
You know, I'm really glad you asked me that question, because I was once asked how those things shaped my imagination. So I'm going to alter it a little and talk about that. I think that it was a combination. There was a lot of sensual pleasure. There was a lot of sensual pleasure on the walls of my grandparents' grand houses that I would go to on the weekends or on the in the summer or whatever. And then coming home to our house in Jersey City, which was, you know, fairly stark and purposely modest, you know, I did start to understand, you know, my imagination learned how to work. And the church next door. You know, there was a lot of material for one's flights of fancy. And just to go back to the serious part of your question, it was confusing. You know, it was confusing to live among people who had so much less than I did and know that somehow, you know, there was that difference. But also there was the knowledge that my parents were trying to do something to change that, and that I was part of that, that we were all trying to do something to change that.
Did people ever talk about Bishop Moore, this person with the background of that enormous wealth, trying to reach out to the poor and do something about their condition? Did people ever talk suspiciously or negatively about that?
Not to me.
I want to talk about your psychiatrist.
Which one?
I thought it was just incredibly startling, wonderful that you could get your father to go to therapy with you, with all the estrangement and the conflict and the separateness and all that's gone on, that he would go with you to a therapist.
Well, it's a tribute to him, really, because we were so estranged. I was so angry at him because he wouldn't talk to me about this hidden aspect of his life, and I just couldn't be with him, just not talking, telling the truth. And I was living in New York for a few months then, and he wrote me and said, I want to see you. And I wrote back and said, only if you'll come to therapy with me. And he said, yes. And I thought it was extraordinary that he did that. He was in his late 70s. And he, you know, my stepmother was very ill at the, you know, starting to be quite ill. And, you know, it was a real tribute. And it was very, very painful. And also kind of miraculous, because we spoke to each other in the way with a witness, in a way that we had never had the courage to do without a witness. And so I remain extraordinarily grateful for having done something. I actually resisted it for a long time, but.
And he got very angry at you many times during those sessions.
And I got angry at him. But I also was able to say everything I had to say in these incredible paragraphs. Because I had been thinking about what I wanted to say to him for so long that it kind of came out in these paragraphs. I'd say, if you aren't so oversensitive... And I'd say, well, I am oversensitive. You know, I am sensitive. So are you.
But you were together, somewhere in the book, you said 10 hours in therapy.
Yeah, not all at once. Five sessions of 2 hours each.
Another sort of hard part in that book for me, the occasion of going back to a woman you left at a bar, and you saw a message scrawled in the dust on the trunk of a car, Dyke, kill the Dyke. And you write, "There I was subjected to what any woman who has had sex with another woman is subject to. And now my father had been subject to what any man who has sex with another man is subject to." And you felt a deep sorrow that your father had to go through such suffering. And then you go on to talk about gay and proud. Whoever I am, I must make my way. My father's secret had cost him greatly. And then you say, if I continued to sit in judgment of him, then I was no better than his enemies. Talk a little bit about how what you know of the deep inner struggle of Paul Moore with his sexuality.
In the therapy, in one of the therapy sessions, he described going on the road for his own memoir, which came out in 1998, in which he did not disclose his sexuality, though we had talked about I had tried to get him to do it, as had other people. And but he was sitting in therapy, and he said, "You know, people come up to me and they say, 'You've had an extraordinary life.'" And then he said, "And I say to myself, 'If only they knew the truth.'" And in that moment, I was so heartbroken, and I just felt nobody should have to feel that way for one half second. You know, I just couldn't bear it. And the other thing he talked about was he said, "Well, I just can't help how I was made."
Mm.
And I said, how you're made is wonderful, you know. I mean, but it was amazing. It was a heartbreaking moment. That someone should like, well, anyone, but that my magnificent, extraordinary father should have to feel that way about his magnificent, extraordinary self.
Your being with women,
mm-hmm.
your being with men,
mm-hmm.
all with integrity. Andrew, your father's sexual life for 30 years, eventually marries a woman. It is a little confusing to me.
Or...
And yet, it does reveal to me that malleability of sexual identity, that incredible mystery that surrounds who we are as sexual people.
Yes.
Talk about that.
I
mean, before reading that book, I did not... The lenses of looking at bisexuality were blurry, and I did not have the feeling of positive embracing of that I feel I'm moving to for reading that book, but I'm not sure I understand it.
I feel that bisexuality is a description of experience which whoever makes up these terms has invented to describe what is really mysterious. And a woman I knew her in Los Angeles. She's dead now. In her mid-70s, she fell in love with a woman. And we went and had coffee, and she said, and I said, "Well, I've just gone back to men," or whatever. And she said, "Well, don't you think we need different things at different times in our life?" I mean, that was one kind of description of it. So all I can say about, but I used to be very judgmental of bisexuality. I'd say, "Well, what does that mean, that you're with someone of your own sex on Monday?" someone of the opposite sex on Wednesday, you know. And that didn't make sense to me. But it does make sense to me as a description of experience.
I, as a heterosexual person married 32 years, I could have a desire to somehow be with a man, and that would have would not in any way describe my sexuality.
Mm-hmm.
That is mysterious.
It's mysterious.
Bishop Gene Robinson is a gay, openly gay bishop in the Episcopal Church, and that has caused the Anglican Communion great grief. And the Anglican Communion could easily be broken apart over the gay issue. Now, I don't believe Paul Moore could have had the great transformative ministry he had over 50 years ago had he revealed his sexuality. And so he was a closet gay.
Mm-hmm.
I feel badly because of the need for some gay people to be in the closet.
Mm-hmm.
And yet I see Paul Moore years ago, 50 years ago, and I understand that
mm-hmm.
a lot more than I understand it today.
Mm-hmm.
Talk about that a little bit.
There were a couple of people, gay men whom I talked to when I was doing this book. One was a man named Louis Crewe, who founded Integrity, which is the Episcopal gay organization. Another was a man named Colin Coward, who founded something called Changing Attitude, and he's actually talked about a bit in the current Harper's Magazine article about the Anglican Communion. And both of them said, it seems to me your father made a choice. He made a choice, the only choice he could have made about what he wanted to do in the world and in his life. I think probably he did make a choice, but I'm not sure how conscious that choice was, because things were so different, 50, 60 years ago. I've come to feel... what I've come to feel is that the closet, has very painful consequences, even if it's the only choice someone can make. And I was thinking about it last Sunday, actually. I was thinking about the story of the woman taken in adultery, and Jesus asks, they bring her to Jesus, and they say, this woman was taken in adultery in the very act. And Moses said we should stone such a person, and master, what do you think? And Jesus is writing with a stick on the ground. God only knows what he's writing, but he's writing with a stick on the ground. And he looks up and he says, whoever of you is without sin, let him cast the first stone, and he goes back to writing on the ground, and then everybody goes away, and he looks up, and the woman is left there, and he says, woman, has anyone condemned you? And she said, no. And he said, well, I don't condemn you either. Go thou and sin no more. And I was thinking about that. It's really a portrait of a communal sin, that the whole culture was bound up in this kind of blaming, judgmental, communal sin. And I think the closet, in a way, is a kind of communal sin. If you think about the word sin, or a communal evil participated in by a whole society. And I think it's wonderful that it's being broken apart, broken open.
I want to, before our time runs out, I want to deal a little bit with Paul Moore's theological statement, and very fascinating to me as you describe it. In the human psyche, religious emotion and sexual feelings come from the same mysterious, undifferentiated source, the human life of love and the divine life of love are not separate, but part of God's love that sweeps through the universe. That's a magnificent statement. Mm. And is that, do you live in that? Is that how you look at it?
It is. I mean, I he first told it to me when I interviewed him for a magazine in 1977, and I listened to the tape again, and then he'd also written it in his book, Take a Bishop Like Me, which is about his ordination of the first lesbian, a priest. And I think it's beautiful. I think it's very especially interesting to think about now.
Yeah, yeah. I think that we have to close this part so that we can have some questions. But I just love the description of the funeral.
Okay, I'll read you that last.
Why don't you read that?
At the closing of my father's funeral, the celebrant gave the blessing, and nearly 500 priests and deacons and bishops and nuns and monks, men and women and acolytes and choirs filed up the aisle of St. John the Divine. And at the end of the procession, slowly moved the pallbearers carrying the plain pine coffin, my father's grandchildren. Over 15, all boys, but for one girl leading, the grand organ thundering a recessional. The service had lasted 3 hours. The cathedral, which seats 3,000, had been packed. I was in the dream of it. I had spoken from the pulpit. 5 of his children had. My father wore robes of crimson and gilt, of green, of purple, of black, of white and gold, I'd said, summoning my little girl's sense of this great figure. Now, as his coffin passed me, I stepped out into the aisle and joined the crush of family. There are nearly 40 of us now. The organist was playing Bach, a saxophone, spinning a descant into the dark reaches of the arched Gothic ceiling, faces from my whole life whirling in my peripheral vision as I follow. And then I look up, and the cathedral doors, the doors that open only at Easter for the bishop's entrance, are now wide open, throwing a shaft of light onto the pale surface of the pine coffin, the waxy shine reflecting daylight radiance. And as we move out through the doors, the coffin moving forward, I see that the stairs of the cathedral, scores of stairs that spill downward from the arched entrance, are crowded with bishops and priests and nuns and monks in their vestments and habits. Their red and their white, their African or Asian vestments, their Trappist and Franciscan habits and rope sashes, their tippets, cottas, surplices and cassocks, and they are clapping as my father's coffin is borne slowly down the stairs, clapping, not applauding, and not exactly rhythmically clapping either, solemnity on their faces as if a medieval guild were bidding farewell to one of its own, their hands coming together, the sound both very loud and barely audible as I stand there, eyes burning in the coffin, the light of the white sky blazing from it slides into the open trunk of the black hearse. And then I understand that this is the end of my father, that inside the coffin is his body, and that when I see him again, he will be ashes. And so, as the clapping continues, I fly down the final steps, the attendants moving away from the open doors of the hearse, and I touch the wood. Alone there, I touch the coffin, at the same time, seeing myself in black, a woman bending toward a coffin, her hand reaching.
Thank you. I'm told that we have 15 minutes for questions, and that you're not to speak until the microphone is put before you. Right, where's the microphone? Right here, please.
Hi, I would love to ask you, if my foreign observation is correct, from my observation in America, the perception of homosexuality very much depends on geography. In California, it was pretty liberal and perception, like some sitcom suggests, Three's Company. In other places.
Now, what's your question now to honor more?
If my observation is correct, that it's geographical matter or not. This is the question.
Yes, I think that. Places that are more liberal and progressive have greater numbers of gay people.
Could you describe the effects of writing this book upon your family?
I can't, actually. All I can say is that I have 8 brothers and sisters, and we're 17 years apart, and we have many different responses to, they have had many different responses to the book.
And those responses have changed, too, right?
They've changed and deepened and will continue to change, I'm sure. I mean, it's still a very new book for all of us.
I'd like to thank you. It's the most evocative, poignant book I've read, from the profile, from the prologue to the final steps, the last steps. My question is this, and George Regas raised it in terms of your father's theology, in which he said that he believed that in the human psyche, religious emotion and sexual feeling come from the same mysterious, undifferentiated source. And it was such a beautiful statement, but elsewhere in your book, you quote your father as saying, well, it was an addiction, and he also felt shame. And I'm wondering what your sense is whether your father was able to integrate his theology, or whether he was able to move beyond the idea of addiction and shame towards the end.
I think that the shame was absolutely there. I'm not sure that addiction wasn't simply a way to not have a conversation. I think he did move further toward integration as he got older. And who knows what would have happened had he lived to be 100.
How shocked were you when he called you on the telephone and told you? And how much earlier in your life had you maybe thought that there was this other part of your father's life?
I had never thought it. And I had been told it by a friend of my mother's, and I sort of had just gone into denial. So I was shocked, and then there were things I put together, and part of the story of the book is talking about the things I put together.
Good. Right back in there, please.
I'd like to go to the question that regarding religious emotion and sexual feeling and that being the same source. I think it's most interesting that your father was on the Isle of Patmos, where John supposedly lived, and John is the beloved disciple of Jesus. And all sorts of talk about their relationship, and what was Jesus and John, what were they together? What is it in a patriarchal church, and I have to include Roman Catholicism here because I am of that.
In spades.
Yes. And what is it in the patriarchal church about the male priesthood that constructs sexuality in this way, in such a harmful way?
I could not.
Maybe that's your
question. I could not agree more. You answer. And then I will answer.
I think it's history. I mean, I think it's... I think you answered the question in your asking it. I mean, I think that the patriarchal churches do construct sexuality in a very destructive way. And I think that the more that's challenged, the more our societal attitudes towards sexuality will change and open. And I think what my father was driving at was exactly that integration, that, you know, allowing sexuality to be seen and felt as God's gift of pleasure and physical love.
I think that what the church has done through its attitude towards sexuality is incredibly destructive. And it's the seedbed of perversion. It's the seedbed of perversion. I mean, one of the comments that Anna makes in the book was when she asked about sex before marriage, her father didn't tell her it was a sin, and how liberating that was to you. But how we surround human sexuality with so many questions and so many judgments. It's very difficult in many churches for people to grow up with a liberated sense of who I am and what my, as a sexual person, I'm beautiful and good and holy. Anna makes the statement that she would have been a different kind of woman had she grown up with women priests. Mm-hmm. I think that's over here's a question, please.
Ms. Moore, it seemed to me that with your story that you had to tell, you had three options. I mean, one would have been to have done nothing, just lived with life as it was. The second would have been for you to do what you did, write and publish. The third would have been to have written the manuscript with all the blessings and the reconciliation, the harmony that gave you, and then put it away. Mm-hmm. Did you think about that possibility?
No, I didn't. No, it's a story I wanted to tell, and I'm a writer, and I publish. You know, that's my life, and I publish not for any crass reasons, but because it's part of my work. Communication is part of my work.
But you said to me as we talked that writing the story, it's was a transformation.
Yes.
And putting it out there was part of your own transformation.
I actually hadn't exactly thought that part, but I think it's true. I mean, it's here I am talking about these issues which have concerned me very deeply and given me a lot of pain in the open, and that's transforming. It's transforming.
I'd like to mention your mother. I mean, one thing that struck me as I read the book was how much energy both your parents must have had to do all the things they did.
Mm-hmm.
And the process of evoking that very optimistic post-World War II time and of learning about your parents' lives was what moved me most about the book.
Yeah.
And your parents' letters were also very sexual.
Mm-hmm.
And I wondered if you could talk a little about the process of going back and reading that and getting to know them in a way that obviously you couldn't have when you were under their roof.
Well, I thought of them, you know, they were 21 and 25, and I sort of thought, I didn't think of them as my grown-up parents whom I knew. I thought of them as these kids who were trying to relate, by mail. He was away in the war, and she was back east, and then part of that time she was pregnant with me. And I found them very moving and sort of delightful, and I found the writing, particularly my mother's writing, so fantastically witty and charming that I was delighted by the letters, and kind of fascinated.
If you would permit me a quick testimonial about your father before making my question. I spoke to him only once over the phone, and he was extremely responsive and warm. It had to do with the one bishop that opened the doors within our own denomination. I'm a United Methodist, and It was Bishop Melvin Wheatley. Mm-hmm. It was around the time that your father had written Take a Bishop Like Me. And for that reason alone, I would be here, wonderful man. And I really believe that Gene Robinson would not have been possible had it not been for your father's outspoken defense of gay people. Mm. And I want you to know that at least within my denomination, the bishops that are closeted, that have been closeted, have been homophobic in their pronouncements, mm-hmm. as if to deflect anyone mm-hmm. from looking at them. Mm-hmm. Now my question has to do with heterosexuality. Can we be equally understanding and compassionate and accepting of those who might have or do have heterosexual secrets that they do not reveal to their children?
Mm. Well, I think we have to find our way through all of this. Yes. Yes.
But every secret are all secrets ultimately destructive?
I can't pronounce on that. I mean, that's my secrets have always been destructive in my life. I mean, lifelong deep secrets whose revelation has a kind of reality altering impact. I mean, I think there's such a thing as discretion and.
I'd like for us sometime to continue that question, because it's very complicated.
Yes.
Because we all live with secrets.
Yes.
We all live with secrets. And so what do we do with it? Over here.
Honor, you were drawn to write this book. You said you're a poet and you write what comes into you, etc. And I wonder if you would... I kind of have a two-part question. One is, how are you different now that you've written this book? And also, writing about your father, who's in heaven, how would you describe your relationship to him now at the end of the process of writing this book?
I just love him. And I get so much pleasure in hearing stories about him now. I used to not, because I couldn't sort of be open-hearted about them. I can say that the process of writing it was transformative for me, and it gave me my father. It gave me my parents, it gave me my father, it gave me, a sense of what my life has been in those relationships that could free me in a way into the present, finally at the age of 62. And it was also testament to the fact that we continue to transform ourselves, and that it's possible to keep looking at relationships again and having those transformations.
The last question and answer sort of get at what I was going to raise. Your father and I overlapped in seminary, and I remember you sitting out there with a nanny when I was a senior and he was a junior. But what I wanted to say is that inevitably the conversation goes towards poor Paul Moore and the bishop and his double life and so on. You gave us the book. I'm grateful to you and to my children and to that generation because you led us to see some of the depths of that theoretical statement about love that we didn't know. So I guess I've got to ask a question, and it is, how does it feel to you for the conversation always to turn to your father and to that whole thing and not as much to you as the last question did?
Well, I did. I mean, it's interesting to me that it turns to him, and I was only struck by it because there was a review, I can't remember what review, that actually talked about me. I was like, oh, I mean, I know the book is about our relationship, and I thought you were going to ask something else, and I just want to say this because I think it's interesting. I think that my generation, what in Europe they call the generation of 68, our revolution has been the sexual revolution. It is natural for us to speak through the prism of sexuality, and so it was natural for me to write this kind of book. It didn't feel transgressive. It felt of a piece with my work.
Okay.
Yeah. I came to the Episcopal Church through your father, through John Luce, and I was happy to know that they're in the book. Yeah. I mean, John's in the book. Ash Wednesday, before your father died, he came to Los Angeles to say goodbye to family and to have lunch with Malcolm Boyd. So I put him in the room with our bishops. I took a picture of your father with our bishops. But before that, I had an hour with him and a film crew, and I interviewed your father for an hour. I'd love to make a copy and send it to you because it's just a history of the Episcopal Church through his eyes, and most especially on the social justice part of his life. That was so meaningful to me because that's what made me put the gospel into action. It is a treasure.
Well, I'd love
last
to.
Last question over here. Wait a minute.
You have to have the microphone.
My wife and I lived near you in Washington for several years, and I knew your father slightly, and I knew his marriage, and I knew of all the children. And I remember that your mother was very revered by all the church people. What about her in all of this? How would you describe her experience and how she ended up with this?
Well, my mother died when she was 50 years old, and she's a big character in the book, but I talk about, the most notable thing is that she had come to figure out that my father had this double life. She never confronted him, and she never revealed it to any of us. And I thought that was a great gift that she gave my father at her extreme expense.
I want to just close with a story about Richard Grine. He was the bishop who succeeded Paul Moore as the Bishop of New York and who defeated me as a candidate in the race for the Bishop of New York. He was jealous of Paul Moore, and he inhibited him, made it impossible for him to perform the sacramental acts of a bishop, inhibited him for 2 years on really what proved to be false claims. I just remind you that Grine was embroiled in a scandal. He left his wife, ran off with a woman priest, divorced his wife and married the woman. So the complexities abound. Thank you so much, Honor.
Aloud Audio is presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through the generosity of the law firm Arendt Fox. Additional support is provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, City National Bank, KPMG, contributors to the Stay Home and Read a Book Ball, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KCRW 89.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and KCET. Aloud theme composed by David Ornette Cherry.